These recent episodes forcefully demonstrate that Section 5's preclearance requirement is constitutional as applied to Alabama and its political subdivisions. And under our case law, that conclusion should suffice to resolve this case. This court has consistently rejected constitutional challenges to legislation enacted pursuant to Congress's enforcement powers under the Civil War amendments upon finding that the legislation was constitutional as applied to the particular set of circumstances before the court. A similar approach is warranted here. The VRA's exceptionally broad severability provision makes it particularly inappropriate for the court to allow Shelby County to mount a facial challenge to Sections 4B and 5 of the VRA, even though application of those provisions to the county falls well within the bounds of Congress's legislative authority. The severability provision states, if any provision of this act or the application thereof to any person or circumstances is held invalid, the remainder of the act and the application of the provision to other persons not similarly situated or to other circumstances shall not be affected thereby. In other words, even if the VRA could not constitutionally be applied to certain states, example, Arizona and Alaska, Section 1973P calls for those unconstitutional applications to be severed, leaving the act in place for jurisdictions as to which its application does not transgress constitutional limits. Nevertheless, the court suggests that limiting the jurisdictional scope of the VRA in an appropriate case would be to try our hand at updating the statute. Just last term, however, the court rejected this very argument when addressing a materially identical severability provision, explaining that such a provision is Congress's explicit textual instruction to leave unaffected the remainder of the act if any particular application is unconstitutional. Leaping to resolve Shelby County's facial challenge without considering whether application of the VRA to Shelby County is constitutional, or even addressing the VRA's severability provision, the court's opinion can hardly be described as an exemplar of restrained and moderate decision-making. Quite the opposite. Hubris is a fit word for today's demolition of the VRA. Section B. The court stops any application of Section 5 by holding that Section 4B's coverage formula is unconstitutional. It pins this result in large measure to the fundamental principle of equal sovereignty. In Katzenbach, however, the court held, in no uncertain terms, that the principle applies only to the terms upon which states are admitted to the Union, and not to the remedies for local evils which have subsequently appeared. Katzenbach, the court acknowledges, rejected the notion that the equal sovereignty principle operates as a bar on differential treatment outside the context of the admission of new states. But the court clouds that once clear understanding by citing dictum from Northwest Austin to convey that the principle of equal sovereignty remains highly pertinent in assessing subsequent disparate treatment of states. If the court is suggesting that dictum in Northwest Austin silently overruled Katzenbach's limitation on the equal sovereignty doctrine to the admission of new states, the suggestion is untenable. Northwest Austin cited Katzenbach's holding in the course of declining to decide whether the VRA was constitutional or even what standard of review applied to the question. In today's decision, the court ratchets up what was pure dictum in Northwest Austin, attributing breadth to the equal sovereignty principle in flat contradiction of Katzenbach. The court does so with nary an explanation of why it finds Katzenbach wrong, let alone any discussion of whether stare decisis nonetheless counsels adherence to Katzenbach's ruling on the limited significance of the equal sovereignty principle. Today's unprecedented extension of the equal sovereignty principle outside its proper domain, the admission of new states, is capable of much mischief. Federal statutes that treat states disparately are hardly novelties. Do such provisions remain safe given the court's expansion of equal sovereignty's sway? Of gravest concern, Congress relied on our path-making Katzenbach decision in each reauthorization of the VRA. It had every reason to believe that the Act's limited geographical scope would weigh in favor of, not against, the Act's constitutionality. Congress could hardly have foreseen that the VRA's limited geographic reach would render the Act constitutionally suspect. Supporters of the Act sought to develop an evidentiary record for the principal purpose of explaining why the covered jurisdictions should remain covered, rather than justifying the coverage of certain jurisdictions but not others. In the court's conception, it appears, defenders of the VRA could not prevail upon showing what the record overwhelmingly bears out, i.e., that there is a need for continuing the preclearance regime in covered states. In addition, the defenders would have to disprove the existence of a comparable need elsewhere. I am aware of no precedent for imposing such a double burden on defenders of legislation. Section C. The court has time and again declined to upset legislation of this genre unless there was no or almost no evidence of unconstitutional action by states. No such claim can be made about the congressional record for the 2006 VRA reauthorization. Given a record replete with examples of denial or abridgment of a paramount federal right, the court should have left the matter where it belongs, in Congress's bailiwick. Instead, the court strikes Section 4B's coverage provision because, in its view, the provision is not based on current conditions. It discounts, however, that one such condition was the preclearance remedy in place in the covered jurisdictions, a remedy Congress designed both to catch discrimination before it causes harm and to guard against return to the old ways. Volumes of evidence supported Congress's determination that the prospect of retrogression was real. Throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. But the court insists the coverage formula is no good. It's based on decades-old data and eradicated practices. Even if the legislative record shows, as engaging with it would reveal, that the formula accurately identifies the jurisdictions with the worst conditions of voting discrimination, that is of no moment as the court sees it. Congress, the court decrees, must start from scratch. I do not see why that should be so. Congress's chore was different in 1965 than it was in 2006. In 1965, there were a small number of states, which in most instances were familiar to Congress by name, on which Congress fixed its attention. In drafting the coverage formula, Congress began work with reliable evidence of actual voting discrimination in a great majority of the states it sought to target. The formula Congress eventually evolved to describe these areas also captured a few states that had not been the subject of congressional fact-finding. Nevertheless, the court upheld the formula in its entirety, finding it fair to infer a significant danger of the evil in all places the formula covered. The situation Congress faced in 2006 when it took up reauthorization of the coverage formula was not the same. By then, the formula had been in effect for many years, and all the jurisdictions covered by it were familiar to Congress by name. The question before Congress, was there still a sufficient basis to support continued application of the preclearance remedy in each of those already identified places? There was at that point no chance that the formula might inadvertently sweep in new areas that were not subject to congressional findings. And Congress could determine from the record whether the jurisdictions captured by the coverage formula still belonged under the preclearance regime. If they did, there was no need to alter the formula. That is why the court, in addressing prior reauthorizations of the VRA, did not question the continuing relevance of the formula. Consider once again the components of the record before Congress in 2006. The coverage provision identified a known list of places with an undisputed history of serious problems with racial discrimination in voting. Recent evidence relating to Alabama and its counties was there for all to see. Multiple Supreme Court decisions had upheld the coverage provision, most recently in 1999. There was extensive evidence that due to the preclearance mechanism, conditions in the covered jurisdictions had notably improved. And there was evidence that preclearance was still having a substantial real-world effect, having stopped hundreds of discriminatory voting changes in the covered jurisdictions since the last reauthorization. In addition, there was evidence that racial polarization in voting was higher in covered jurisdictions than elsewhere, increasing the vulnerability of minority citizens in those jurisdictions. And countless witnesses, reports, and case studies documented continuing problems with voting discrimination in those jurisdictions. In light of this record, Congress had more than a reasonable basis to conclude that the existing coverage formula was not out of sync with conditions on the ground in covered areas. And certainly Shelby County was no candidate for release through the mechanism Congress provided. The court holds Section 4B invalid on the ground that it is irrational to base coverage on the use of voting tests 40 years ago when such tests have been illegal since that time. But the court disregards what Congress set about to do in enacting the VRA. That extraordinary legislation scarcely stopped at the particular tests and devices that happened to exist in 1965. The grand aim of the act is to secure to all in our polity equal citizenship stature, a voice in our democracy undiluted by race. As the record for the 2006 reauthorization makes abundantly clear, second-generation barriers to minority voting rights have emerged in the covered jurisdictions as attempted substitutes for the first-generation barriers that originally triggered preclearance in those jurisdictions. The sad irony of today's decision lies in its utter failure to grasp why the VRA has proven effective. The court appears to believe that the VRA's success in eliminating the specific devices extant in 1965 means that preclearance is no longer needed. With that belief, and the argument derived from it, history repeats itself. The same assumption that the problem could be solved when particular methods of voting discrimination are identified and eliminated was indulged and proved wrong repeatedly prior to the VRA's enactment. Unlike prior statutes, which singled out particular tests or devices, the VRA is grounded in Congress's recognition of the variety and persistence of measures designed to impair minority voting rights. In truth, the evolution of voting discrimination into more subtle second-generation barriers is powerful evidence that a remedy as effective as preclearance remains vital to protect minority voting rights and prevent backsliding. Beyond question, the VRA is no ordinary legislation. It is extraordinary because Congress embarked on a mission long delayed and of extraordinary importance to realize the purpose and promise of the 15th Amendment. For half a century, a concerted effort has been made to end racial discrimination in voting. Thanks to the Voting Rights Act, progress once the subject of a dream has been achieved and continues to be made. The record supporting the 2006 reauthorization of the VRA is also extraordinary. It was described by the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee as one of the most extensive considerations of any piece of legislation that the United States Congress has dealt with in the 27 and a half years he had served in the House. After exhaustive evidence gathering and deliberative process, Congress reauthorized the VRA, including the coverage provision, with overwhelming bipartisan support. It was the judgment of Congress that 40 years had not been sufficient amount of time to eliminate the vestiges of discrimination following nearly 100 years of disregard for the dictates of the 15th Amendment, and to ensure that the right of all citizens to vote is protected as guaranteed by the Constitution. That determination of the body empowered to enforce the Civil War amendments by appropriate legislation merits this court's utmost respect. In my judgment, the court errs egregiously by overriding Congress's decision. For the reasons stated, I would affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.